Why didn't all galaxies stick together at the early stages of the universe? Can we feel the space-time expanding? What if simulating the universe is easier than physically exploring it? And in Q&A Plus, why is Starship so hyped compared to other new rockets? All this and more in this question show. It's time for the question show. Your questions, my answers. As always, wherever you are, across my channel, if a question pops in your brain, just write it down, I'll gather them up, and I'll answer them here. All right, let's get into the questions. Hooves. If galaxies are drawn to each other, why weren't galaxies gravity-bound in the early universe like local galaxies today, when everything was much closer together? Gravity should have been stronger. So the universe that we find ourselves in today is the result of all of the various forces that are operating on the universe. If you sort of roll the clock backwards, then you sort of everything is going in reverse. All of this expansion is going in reverse. And so the galaxies are closer together and they're closer together and closer together. And eventually there are no galaxies. There's just the material for forming stars. And so really the question you're kind of asking is like, why didn't it all just glom up into like one big chunk? And so the answer is just that the momentum left over from the Big Bang was going to tear the universe, like tear the mass away from each other more quickly than the gravity could pull it all together. And the result that you get is that wherever there was more of a density of matter, that pulled in more material. And wherever there was less of a density material, then that caused these voids to open up in between these large scale galactic structures. And if you look out at the universe today, if you look at the large scale structure of the universe, you get these galaxy walls, these huge clusters of galaxies. They're arranged in these long structures that are, in some cases, billions of light years long. And then you have these giant voids. And over time, as the universe continues to get less dense, these voids grow. The places where material is pulling together gets more and more dense. But at the same time, we've got this process of dark energy that is accelerating the de-densification of the universe. And so places that should have drifted together, maybe, you know, it's about 5 million light years away. Like if you get within about 5 million light years of some other galaxy, then your mutual gravity is going to pull you together. But if you're more than that, then the expansive force of dark energy is going to push those galaxies apart faster than the gravity can pull them together. And so eventually, everything except that which is locally bound to us, Andromeda, the Triangulum Galaxy, a few hundred dwarf galaxies, that's all coming together into the future elliptical galaxy that we're going to become. Everything else is going to be drawn away from us and drawn away from each other. And so it's really just that the Big Bang had so much momentum that it just sheared all of that material apart faster than the gravity could pull it together. Steve Ross, what if simulating the universe is technologically easier than physically going to and exploring the whole universe? Could that solve the Fermi paradox? Maybe they just watch us on alien computers. It's funny, we got almost this exact question on AstronomyCast earlier today and answered it there. And so this is great because it's all kind of fresh in my brain. Our computers are getting better and better every year, and they're getting more and more accurate and more powerful in what they can simulate in the universe. But the level of detail that they can simulate in these simulations is, you know, a galaxy or particles in a galaxy, and that can also simulate some of the dark matter and the effects of dark energy, and even starting to simulate things like neutrinos moving through the galaxy. But it's still a very rough simulation. They're at the point now where they can start just after the Big Bang, they can run the simulation forward, and they can see the results that look roughly the way the universe looks today. And that's a very good sign that your simulation ends up simulating a thing that is kind of like how the universe looks. And there's a whole bunch of new observatories that are coming online or have already come online in the last couple of years. This is a big priority for the astronomical community, which is to understand the shape and the composition of the universe at different epochs. So there's four missions, or I guess there's four instruments missions that have come out or about to come out. So the first one is the DESI survey, the Dark Energy Spectroscopic Instrument, which is a ground-based telescope. There's the Euclid mission, which has been launched by the European Space Agency. There's the upcoming Vera Rubin telescope, and then there's the Nancy Grace Roman telescope. So two space telescopes, two ground observatories, and they're trying to map out the composition of the universe at different times. So how much was dark matter? How much was dark energy? Where was the dark matter? Where was the dark energy? What about stars? How are they moving? And just get a sense of that all the way back to the beginning of time. And then you have much better information that you can then put into your simulation to try to predict what the future of the universe would evolve into and make a better job of doing those simulations. But simulating like a galaxy or even simulating star systems and planets forming in star systems, if you can get to the place where you start your simulation and you start by simulating from the Big Bang, it goes all the way through galaxies and it simulates all the way to stars and it shows the right compositions of stars and it simulates planets orbiting around those stars, you don't get life, right? You don't get simulations of life from that. Simulating life is going to be some totally different process. And maybe one day you can kind of mash those things together where you're simulating the large scale structure of the universe and you're also simulating the chemical composition on some planet that's giving you the first life forms. Then you're somehow integrating them together. So I think it'll be a long, long time. But your suggestion about the Fermi paradox that advanced civilizations maybe turn inward, I think that's a very legitimate possibility that, you know, once a civilization gets so advanced, then there's sort of like more to explore in their virtual worlds than there is in the real universe, which is a very weird thing to say because the real universe is the thing that's real. But what if you could make an unlimited amount of things to consider, things to explore in this virtual world, and that becomes more interesting to this civilization. And so all you have to do is run very powerful computers, and then you don't even have to risk the danger of space travel, but you can run these ancestor simulations. And that's where the simulation hypothesis kind of comes together, where you say, okay, if you know we're going to be simulating the universe or some reality, and our simulations are going to get better over time. Eventually, our simulations will get so good that we're running a ton of simulations, millions of simulations, billions of simulations. And in those simulations, other people will be running more simulations. And then you say, so are we in a simulation? And like mathematically speaking, maybe, but there's no way to tell. So yeah, I think there's a possibility that any advanced civilization is going to find, and this could be inevitable, right? Like this could be the great filter, that these advanced civilizations find it inevitable that the most interesting thing is to not bother exploring the cosmos. It's to search, you know, to explore these virtual worlds that they're creating. But then you put yourself at risk to the civilizations that don't do that, and they just land grab, right? When the board comes by, they don't care if you're just playing your video game. So it makes sense to also explore the real universe. And so now I'm back to square one. I saw images. Why can't we feel the expansion if it's happening to space-time? My cells are getting farther apart. Could it be that the strong nuclear force is getting weaker? So the expansion of the universe is happening at the largest scales, and it is a very, very weak process. So weak that almost every other force is millions, billions of times stronger than this force of the expansion. I'll give you some examples of things that are stronger than other things. So for example, you take a magnet and you put it on your refrigerator. Now, the magnetism that's holding the magnet to your fridge is stronger than the gravitational mass of the entire Earth that is underneath it trying to pull that magnet off of the fridge. And yet the magnet is very strong. That the atomic force that is holding your body, you know, your atoms together, is stronger than the gravity that's trying to pull you into a blob. That's, you know, how stronger the forces are that hold on to our body. And so, yeah, there is dark energy. And if dark energy works the way people think it does, then it is this expansive force that is happening everywhere in the universe, even a little bit inside your body. But the strength of that expansion is minuscule compared to the force that is holding all of the parts of your body, the chemical bonds that are holding your molecules together, the atomic bonds that are holding your atoms together, the gravity that is holding the planet together, that's keeping you down on the planet. All of that is just ludicrously stronger. It's only when you get to about 5 million light years away, double the distance than Andromeda, where the force of gravity between two galaxies that are trying to pull each other together is overcome by the dark energy expansion that is trying to push them apart. And that's the point where two galaxies won't be able to pull together because this dark energy is pushing them apart. But closer than that, gravity is dominant. Closer than that, the chemical bonds holding your molecules together is dominant. The atomic force is what's dominant. It's time to shout out our new patrons at the $5 level and above. Vo Mazieres, Yochin Zimmer, Mackinon, Alvaro Blay Semper, Vince, Eyelash on Your Screen, Vladi, Leza Korchowski, Bob, and Lan. Join our community at patreon.com/universe today. Michael Shea, when talking to physicists, do you get the sense that there's a growing consensus that LCDM is wrong or at least flawed? LCDM is the Lambda Cold Dark Matter model. Say that five times fast. And that is the scientific consensus right now for the domination of dark matter in the universe. And not just that dark matter is the dominant source of mass in the universe, but it is a kind of particle that is cold as opposed to hot. So neutrinos are hot particles that don't interact with anything and they move very quickly at close to the speed of light. And whatever dark matter is, it is probably cold in that it doesn't move very quickly and kind of hangs around in big blobs that can then interact with regular matter with its gravity. And so no, absolutely not. When you talk to the scientific community, you talk to astronomers, the Lambda CDM model is the one that is considered to be the scientific consensus right now. It makes predictions that accurately match the observations that astronomers are making of the universe better than anything that's ever been thought of so far. And that's why that model, you know, you look at the explanations that dark matter makes and you can make further predictions. You see how the rotation curves of galaxies match, whether there's a big halo of dark matter around a galaxy. And then you can see the gravitational microlensing from dark matter as its sort of large chunks of it are causing light to bend in subtle ways. And there's a lot of experiments that are being done right now that are going to map that out with better accuracy in the coming years. And, you know, I think that when James Webb first launched, there was this initial rush and it was finding a lot of stuff that was very interesting. And there wasn't a lot of time to really do a deep analysis. Specifically, there wasn't time to do the spectroscopic analysis on the most distant galaxies. And so you got a lot of papers, kind of a rush for papers for people to say, oh, we found this really big galaxy early on in the universe. We found this surprisingly large supermassive black hole early in the universe. And then you got sort of a regular cast of characters that show up every time there's any kind of controversy who pull out their paper that they've been waving around for 30 years and they go, pick me, right? I can explain why the universe isn't working the way the theories had expected. And their ideas have been disproven already. They've failed to make predictions that match the observations. They have been discarded a long time ago, but for ego reasons or whatever, they can't let it drop. And so they switched to marketing. And so after James Webb came online, we saw a lot of marketing. And that's the word I want to use, is marketing, from people who have alternative theories about the universe, but don't have the evidence to back it up, don't have the peer-reviewed literature to back up what they're saying, who have alternatives to Lambda CDM. Lambda CDM is still very strong. Now, there are alternatives, and people seriously consider them, but none of them are sort of more widely adopted by the scientific community than this model. And then over time, as more work was done with James Webb, as more spectroscopy was done, after there were interesting discoveries, astronomers made follow-on observations with other instruments, with ALMA, with Chandra, with Hubble, and then you got things starting to make a lot more sense. You know, there's this idea of survivorship bias, that when you're seeing very bright galaxies early on in the universe, is that because all galaxies early on in the universe were bright? Or is it just that you're only able to see the brightest things? And so that's what you see. You don't see all the fainter galaxies. And now over time, we're getting a much better sort of census of what's there in the early universe. You know, and so right now, there are so many lines of evidence that are well supported by this current Lambda CDM model that it's going to take a lot to come up with another model that explains it better. You know, there are a bunch of alternative theories to explain dark matter, and some can explain very specific aspects of dark matter, but they can't explain them all in the way that Lambda CDM does. And so until something comes along that does a better job of explaining all of the current observations, that fills in current mysteries, and then makes predictions for other phenomena that people need to go and look for and confirm, that's the gold standard. Lambda CDM is going to be the one that most people are sort of agreed upon. Karen 156, what calling card would you leave an early Earth-like world that would survive long enough for them to see? So the question you're kind of asking is, like, if we could go to another terrestrial planet around another star, could we leave something in that solar system that then, when they became more technologically advanced, they could find it? And like, this is the plot of 2001, Space Odyssey, right? Where humans find a monolith on the moon and has been left there by aliens and tells us that you're not alone. And then to not go to Europa. It's amazing that Arthur C. Clarke had these ideas. That was a very logical idea, that the best thing to do if you want to leave a message for another civilization that they might not be able to check for a billion years is to leave it in a place that isn't going to have erosion. And that's the moon. Now, obviously, the moon is getting pounded by micrometeorites, and so you leave several of them. And there are other places, like put something out into the asteroid belt, wherever your von Neumann factory was. And that, you know, even if you're, like, if you go to some other star system and you leave the monolith there, and then they rise up and they, you know, because it's like, once you've gotten to the moon, if you've got the technological capability to get to the moon, then you're ready to contemplate the reality that there are other civilizations out there, that you're not alone in the universe. And so that's like a really clever idea. And so it's like really practical. It's a thing that we should definitely do. And I think, you know, we should do that here in the solar system. Like, we could leave some kind of message, monolith, installation on the moon, in the asteroid belt, somewhere that an advanced civilization follows us from the Earth. You know, when the octopuses grow up or whatever, you know, the dolphins go to space, and then they'll find this and they'll learn about us. And it's a way that we can communicate with another civilization, not in distance, but through time into the future. And I really like that idea. It's very poetic to me. So I think that one of the things, and there are plans to do this already, you know, there are lots of artifacts sitting on the moon right now, and people are planning like really tough, long-lasting billion-plus-year installations that are obvious, they're on the moon, easy to find, easy to understand, and will tell some follow-on civilization that we were here, and this is what we were about, and this is what we have, this is our legacy to give you. And I like that idea. Minor downfall. Why is everybody hyped about Starship and nobody is hyped about Ariane 6? I mean, Ariane 6 is cool. It's a new version of the Ariane series. It's got one more, right? It's the sixth. And they're developing a lot of new technology to make this rocket go. But it is still the old paradigm that there's no part of this that is a reusable rocket. Right now, SpaceX has been able to dramatically drop launch costs because they've really invested in this reusable technology. The Falcon 9 can be reused, whatever, more than a dozen times. Many of the different parts of the Falcon are reused. It's just the upper stage that is thrown away. And then as they're developing then the next generation, the Starship, you've got a fully reusable two-stage rocket. If they succeed, you know, and it's still a big if, right? We're not sure this is going to work yet. Although, you know, we saw really good signs with the Flight 11. We didn't see a lot of the heat damage that we saw in previous launches. So if they're able to make this work, then you're launching rockets for really just the cost of fuel and some servicing. That'll bring the cost down another probably order of magnitude. And so any rocket company that isn't investing in some level of reusable technology feels like they're just not going to be able to maintain competitiveness. I mean, Blue Origin, even though they don't really launch rockets, I can make a whole bunch of jokes about Blue Origin, but I won't. You know, their first stage is going to be reusable. Neutron is going to have a lot of reusability. And then in China, I mentioned, you know, there's whatever, 75 rocket companies. Many of them are working on reusable rockets. We've seen reusable rocket tests. And so it's really hard to compete in a market where people are undercutting your cost by half or by a third, right? And so, like, do you choose the Ariane rocket because that's the one that you have to choose because you're a European country launching a European mission? Or do you save half your launch costs and go with a Falcon 9 or save a 10th, you know, save 90% of your launch costs and go with the Starship? So I think that's the problem is, you know, whatever technological advancements they're developing with the Ariane 6, the fact that it's not reusable, the fact that they're not even developing a reusable platform in any way, is the thing that people have the complaint with. All right, those are all the questions that we had this week. Thank everyone who joined me for the live show, everybody who put your questions into the YouTube comments. Now, we record the live show, which is how we sort of construct the question show. We do that every Monday, but it kind of rotates on when we do it. And so if you're watching this right now, shortly after we released it, the next live show is going to be on Monday, November 3rd at 5 p.m. Pacific time. All right, I'm going to give you some cool resources on YouTube for learning astronomy, but first, I'd like to thank our patrons. Thanks to Abe Kingston, Bear Lake Roofing, Brian Bodie, Caradwin, Chuck Hawkins, Commander Bielek, Sian Nielsen, Dark Finga, Dave Verbaugh, David Giltonen, David Matz, Evan Pro, Greg Feely, James Clark, Jeremy Mattern, Jim Burke, Jordan Young, Josh Schultz, Marcel Sitz, Michael Purcell, OneStepForAnimals.org, Paul Robach, Rank Haidu, Richard Williams, Sean Sargent, Stephen Fowler-Munley, Team 49, Telescopes Canada, Vlad Cheplin, and Wolfgang Klotz, who support us at the Master of the Universe level, and all our patrons. All your support means the universe to us. So there are a bunch of amazing lectures and talks on YouTube by astronomers. And so, you know, obviously, you know, I like to interview astronomers, get my questions answered by them, but you can see them sort of speak in their own words at every level. So whether they're giving talks to other astronomers at a professional level, whether they're defending their PhD, or whether they're just teaching their astronomy class. So I want to give you a couple of examples of some resources, and this is just the beginning. You know, in general, if you want something longer, something deeper, if you want to kind of hear directly from the astronomers themselves, I recommend you pick a topic that you want to learn more about, inflation or dark matter or whatever, and then search YouTube and then put in some filters. You know, search for the word lecture and then try to make the length of the video longer than 20 minutes. And then that should give you some possibilities. And then, you know, take a look at the credentials of the people who are doing the talk and you might get some real gems. First up, one great science communicator is Yvette Sendes, and she is an astronomy professor in addition to being a science communicator, and has decided to put her upcoming astronomy class on YouTube. And I want to encourage that. And so I'm going to put a link to that. The channel is Astronomy Here, and I'll put a link in the show notes. The next thing I want to direct you towards is the Silicon Valley Astronomy Lectures. And this is a very large astronomical club in Silicon Valley, and they bring in some amazing guest speakers. And so you're going to hear directly from the researchers, sort of the cutting edge of what they're working on. And then the last resource that I want to give you, and this is sort of like the tried and true, the one you can be totally safe, and this is the Crash Course Astronomy led by Dr. Phil Plate, AKA the Bad Astronomer. And he is a terrific educator. And this is a very long series, many episodes where he just covers every single aspect in space and astronomy. And so if you just want a really great grounding in astronomy, soup to nuts, I highly recommend you watch Crash Course Astronomy with Dr. Phil Plate. All right, we'll see you next time.